This is an interview with Burden Morgan for the California State College of Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Stacy Jagels at his home in Oakhurst, California on Saturday, May 2nd at 10 a.m.
I thought we would start first with when and where you were born.
Well, I was born at Council Hill, Oklahoma, February 13th, 1924.
Could you tell me a little bit about your childhood?
Well, we were farmers, grew up on the farm. Of course, in those days, particularly in that part of the country, you lived in a pretty small world compared to now. By that I mean transportation wasn't like it is, roads were bad, and you didn't get too far from home. So you actually lived in a pretty small world. You have to grow up and look back on it to realize what a small world you were in there, particularly in those times. Schools were a little bit different than they were here, I think, in the respect that there was a lot more discipline there. My dad was an authoritarian. When he said yes, he meant yes. When he said no, he meant exactly that. And you only got one warning. But you were taught to mind, even to strangers. You said sir and ma'am, which was quite different when we came here. We noticed this big difference.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? Were they both born in Oklahoma also?
No, my parents were born in Arkansas, White River Country, which is approximately central eastern Arkansas. And just when my mother came out, I don't know, but he came out to the Indian Territory in 1893 when he was 13 years old. He was born in 1880, my father was. My mother, I think, was approximately 2 years younger than he. But they came in a covered wagon pulled by oxen. And I've heard him tell many times how everything was so loaded that he walked every step of the way and herded the cows along. And of course, the Indian Territory was quite wild in those days. There was outlaw gangs from the six surrounding states where they would do their raiding in the states, hole up in the Indian Territory because it was only subject to federal marshal. And my father, as a young man, sometimes rode with the federal marshal when he'd go after somebody. He used to tell many times about federal marshals didn't stay alive long in that part of the country. They even ran school teachers off when he was young. And later when he became a minister, there was attempts to run him off from places. They didn't want any changes. And they didn't want any schools, they didn't want any ministers, they didn't want anything any other than the way that it was.
And when you say they,
the gangsters, the outlaw gangs. I'm talking about people like the Davis gang and Cole Younger, and my dad mentioned those names with ease. I mean, he knew these people. And in later years, of course, there were still gangs. Most of them were wiped out in the 30s, Pretty Boy Floyd. And Dillinger even sashayed through that territory occasionally, too. As a matter of fact, he came through there with Floyd one particular time in my time that I heard talked about. And he was chased in front of our house by the posse one day. I was out in the front yard. I didn't know who it was. But I remember a submachine gun in the back of the car, and the sheriff's posse in another car, keeping a very respectable distance. And they went west of our place, and about 15 minutes they came back by, empty-handed. And there was a lot of talk about it around there when I was a kid, you know.
What did your father's family do? Were they farmers?
They were farmers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, even in Arkansas. I don't know when my grandfather left Alabama, but he left Alabama because he didn't want his sons working in coal mines. That was his main reason for leaving there.
Mm-hmm. Why did they leave Arkansas?
Well, I suppose for greener pastures. I don't know. I never heard any specific reason. But people were naturally just migrating westward. And why they settled in that particular area, I don't know. They had their reasons, but I never heard them say why. They settled first in a little place that never amounted to a lot. It was called Lena, and it was founded by two of my great uncles. It was in North Canadian River country.
Do you know much about your mother's family?
No, I don't. Very little. Very little.
You said you were the 13th child?
I was the 13th child. My mother was part Cherokee Indian. But then many, many people back there are mixed with Indian. And nothing uncommon at all, and has been for 200 or 300 years, you know. But I really don't know too much about my mother's family. She had one sister that I knew real well, grew up not too far from, and was very fond of. The sister that I'm, the aunt that I'm talking about, married one of the early families back there, by the name of Bibi. Which later when they came to California, they came to Bakersfield, and farmed in the Bakersfield and Shafter area for many years. And the whole family has passed away now, though. The entire family is gone, the Beebe family.
Mm-hmm. And, now, your mother died when you were very young.
I was 6 weeks old.
Mm-hmm. And your father remarried?
My father remarried. I was over a year old when he remarried. And I was kept by another aunt during that time. Because there were so many small ones at home that he needed somebody to take care of me, you know. My aunt, I had a cousin approximately the same age, and she breastfed both of us the entire time, which was, I always thought, quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, now, of these 13 children, you were the youngest. What was the age spread?
My oldest sister was born in 1903, and my oldest brother in 1905. It goes all the way up from the 13 of us to 1924.
Mm-hmm. And did all 13 of you live with your father and your stepmother together, or had some sisters and brothers married?
Some brothers had
or left
home already. And just what years they married, I don't recall because it never meant that much to me at the time. But 1 year, when I started to school, my stepmother packed 10 school lunches. She sent 10 children to school that 1 year. And after that, I don't remember how many of the next and so on, but I remember hearing her talk about it many times, that 1 year she had to pack lunches for 10 children.
Mm-hmm. So as you were growing up, you started out with about 9 brothers and sisters living in the home with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then, since you were the youngest, it would decrease.
Yes, it decreased, but my stepmother had 4 children.
Oh.
Okay. One of them was almost grown. I think she was about 16 when she married my father. And then they had 3 between them in addition to that. So I had 2 half-sisters and a half-brother. My stepmother was a busy woman. And she loved every minute of it. She always said she did.
Did you have a good relationship with her?
Very good. Very good.
You thought of her as your mother then?
Oh, I did. I did. Some of the older ones did not, though. And I think a couple of them had pretty hard feelings towards her, but which I never even discuss it with them, you know, because it doesn't do any good. But all in all, I think she was a great person. She had a tremendous job, and she did it well. And I don't think that she could have worked any harder her entire life if she'd have tried. And she just passed away in 1980, in July. She was 91 and a half. And pretty good health up until the last year before she passed away.
Was this extremely large family you had very unusual where you lived?
Well, ours was larger than the usual, yes. But there were many families back there that had 6 to 9 children in the family.
Did you enjoy having lots of brothers and sisters?
Oh, I think so, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, she had no trouble getting up a ball game. And I remember wondering when I was little and growing up what some of the kids did that didn't have but 1 or 2 brothers or sisters, you know. How they found anything to do. Of course, you don't realize when you're small and you're growing up how hard times really are, see? I can remember them talking about hard times, but I hadn't experienced the good times, so it didn't mean the same thing to me at the time, I'm sure. I have to reflect back on a lot of these things, but now that I have something to compare it with, I can see where people like my father and my stepmother had a tremendous job on their hands to raise that many children with no help. There was no welfare. If there would have been, he wouldn't have taken it anyway. And I call them very successful people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your father was a farmer. Did he own his farm or did he rent the land or share crops?
Oh, for many years he owned land back then.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Depression, he sold what he had and he didn't do anything but lease land until we left there.
Mm-hmm. But when he owned land, do you remember hearing about how much land it was that he owned?
Well, when he was starting out, he used to clear land and get a farm in working order and sell it and repeat the process. And my dad became a minister in his, I'm not sure just what year, but he was a Baptist minister back there for 35 years. And he helped a lot of people. Mm-hmm. He really helped a lot of people. I've heard other people tell this. And he was never so much for patting himself on the back. It was just the thing he had to do, and at the time he was in, and he did what he felt he had to do.
He was a minister in addition to farming the land and taking care of the family there. When he would own land, do you remember if he ever had so much work to do that he would need to hire someone? Or was it yourself and your brothers and sisters that would go out and help him?
Well, back when he owned land, yes, he did hire people. But and sometime during times that I can remember, he hired some help, and particularly in harvest time. But it was customary back there for neighbors to help each other during harvest time. Yeah, I can remember the threshing crews and the big dinners and all that, you know, that went with it. Everything was done. Of course, there was no tractors in our part of the country then at all. It was all done with horses and mules. And when they'd start harvesting, like threshing oats or anything else like that, they'd all bring their own teams over in their own wagons, and they'd haul the oats to the thresher. It was a stationary machine.
Mm-hmm. And so it was very common for your neighbors?
Oh, yes, they helped out. Uh-huh. They helped each other.
If your father could afford to hire some hands to help him at harvest time, then he must have been doing fairly well at that time.
Better than average. Better than average. Mm-hmm. He did better than average. He was a diversified farmer. He didn't just depend on one thing. Mm-hmm. And he had some livestock, some milk cows, something to fall back on, even some chickens. And
so when you were very small, you always remember having enough to eat and enough clothes? And
we always had enough to eat. Now, if we would have had refrigeration, we didn't have electricity, see. We would have eaten very well. But under the circumstances, I think we did real well in the food department. Now, sometimes it would get monotonous from having to eat too much of the same thing for a while. But never do I ever remember there not being plenty to eat, such as it was. It may be beans and potatoes, because you didn't have refrigeration for the meat. And when you killed a beef, this has to be either canned or divided up with neighbors, and then when they do likewise, when
then you would get a share.
You would get some of that, and we had a lot of pork because it was cold enough back there in the wintertime that you could salt it down and smoke part of it, and made sausage and even canned sausage. And I'll say this, it was better than anything you buy today. And we had quite a few chickens. We sold eggs, and we also sold cream. We had a separator. We separated the cream from the milk. We fed the milk to the hogs and sold the cream. Skim milk. Mm-hmm. We didn't drink skim milk. It wasn't good enough. And but things got so bad in 1932 and 3 along there, which I can remember. So I heard them talk about it, and I never forgot it. I remember the day that I walked over to the country church where they had the poll to vote for Franklin Roosevelt, his first term. And that was in 1932. I was 8 years old. And they were discussing on the way home, walking down the country road, how bad things were and how they hoped that he would be able to do something. Well, as it's usually the demise of every politician, when they start trying to do something, then they have a certain share that trying to pull the other direction. Maybe they don't understand what they're trying to do at first, too. That might be part of it. But I know when they, there was a lot of hard feelings when they decided to kill some of the livestock off.
Can we go back
to get the prices up
a little bit more before we get into some of the things that happened during the Depression? I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your father, and if he was a minister. And did he learn to be a minister just in his spare time? Or was he an extremely religious man all his life?
No, he was not an extremely religious man all his life. Of course, as the Baptist religion, I don't know how much you know about it. It's not too unlike some of the other denominations, Methodist and so on. Methods of worship might vary a little, but they have to feel that they're called to preach the Word of God. This he felt he was, and I really believe that he felt he was. I don't think anybody could be any more honest about anything than he was, and I don't see how anybody could live his religion any more than he did. Not that he didn't make mistakes, he did. And I can look back and see some mistakes he made. But he felt he was called to preach, and he had a good knowledge of the Bible. You could ask him any question you wanted to, and he could usually satisfy you with an answer and tell you where to find it. He backed everything up with scripture in the Bible. And he had no trouble recalling which one either. I think he must have been able to memorize the whole Bible.
So it was important for you and your brothers and sisters to go to church then?
It was a must.
Yeah.
We didn't have a choice. We went.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the revivals they would have?
Oh, yes, definitely. Uh-huh. They'd be so hot inside the of course, all the old buildings were uninsulated. Even in California they were when they came here. But they were so hot they'd build a brush arbor outside in the summertime when they'd have a revival. I've gone to a number of them. And that just consisted of poles planted on end and cross members, and then they'd take brush, clip limbs off of trees with the green leaves on them. When they dried, they stayed on. They piled that on top to make a shade. I sat there many a time through those till I thought I would die. And when we were kids, we'd go to sleep. And maybe if you were the small one, they'd take them out in the wagon and put them in the wagon and you'd sleep. And then it was very miserable when you got home to have to wake up and go to bed. You'd have to get undressed, you know, and your children are very sleepy-headed.
So you weren't too interested in these revivals?
No, not at all. It'd go in one ear and out the other.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, were there very many church social events?
Yes, they had what they called box suppers. It was one thing that they would have. And also pie suppers. Just the pies. I've seen my dad auction pies off at a number of those. He was a good auctioneer. They were a lot of fun. The entertainment was very simple. People didn't have, in our area, I think most of the people ate pretty well, but there was no money, no cash money. Give an example. When we had an auction and sold out in 1934, we had a lot of canned fruit and other things that we had canned that we couldn't bring with us. And a lot of it went for 5 cents a jar total. And this would even include canned meat and anything. So nobody had any money to buy anything.
So was bartering fairly common? If you had something and you needed something else, you might trade, say, some eggs for some meat?
Very common. Bartering was a very common thing. You swapped labor with each other. One farmer needed somebody for a day or two, you'd go and help him, and he'd come over and work a day or two for you whenever you needed him. All you had to do is call on him. People band together when it's necessary, as I think they still would.
Mm-hmm. So there was really a close-knit atmosphere there where you lived.
Yes, it was.
It was very close-knit. And could you even compare that to the way things are in California?
Well, they weren't as close-knit in California as they were then. Because I don't think the need was as great. As people get more affluent, they get more independent. I think that's proven in wars. You go to war, and somebody you never knew within 2 weeks can become your best buddy. Because you're so dependent on each other. If your lives depend on each other, then you're going to get close-knit much faster. If there were another calamity that, which I don't think history repeats itself verbatim, I think there would be a lot of differences. People aren't nearly as hard up now as they were then. They just think they are. If their color TV goes out, they're having a hardship. TV didn't exist and no radio, you don't miss it.
Mm-hmm. So you think that the financial hardships really brought people together?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. That.
You mentioned a little bit about school earlier and that you thought the schools, the teachers in El Pomo are much more strict than they were here. Could you tell me a little bit about the school you went to?
My first day at school, I got a spanking because I nudged the fellow that had to sit with me a little too hard and unseated him. He found himself on the floor. And before the next thing I knew, I was bent over the front desk getting whacked. I didn't do it again that day. No, they were very quick to give you a licking in school then. The teacher told you to do something, you didn't do it, you got a spanking. And some of them were pretty hard. I think my record was 4 one day. I was pretty hard to make a believer out of, I guess. I got one for not paying attention. Some teachers were quicker to do this than others. Some would spank harder than others, naturally. Some spank too hard. I've seen a couple of them in school that shouldn't have been given, not to that extent at least.
Did you like school?
Oh, yes.
In spite of all that?
Oh, sure, sure, I liked school. I wouldn't have wanted to have been anywhere else when the other kids were in school. But if if we got into anything serious at school, and my dad got a hold of it, we got another spanking when we got home, and that was the hard one.
Mm-hmm. So it was very important to your father that you were well behaved.
Oh yes, very, very important. When my father would go away for 2 or 3 weeks to a revival that he would be holding somewhere at another church, he would lay out the things to be done while he was gone. And it had better get done while he was gone, or else we heard about it.
And this school that you went to when you were a small boy, was this a one-room schoolhouse?
Yes, it was. And it went from the, what they call primary, through the fourth grade. And then you started school when you were 5 years old, and you went through the primary and first grade in 1 year. Your second year, you were in second grade. And then they consolidated this school with others, and this was also a country school, the next one, but it had been a high school previous to that, was from the fifth grade through the 12th. And it consolidated some of the schools, and the high school kids went into town, and they made that school from primary through eighth. It's called Victor mm-hmm. School. And that's where I went until we came to California. I was in the sixth grade when we came here.
Mm-hmm. Were your studies very important to you then?
Oh, yes.
Did you bring your work home and do your homework? And were you a very diligent student?
If we didn't do our homework, we got spanked, and that's the truth. And not always just with the hand. Most teachers kept a nice board paddle, and a few of them would even drill a few holes in it. This makes it sting a little harder.
Did you have many chores around the house as you got older? You mentioned that when your father went out of town for him to preach his revival, he had a list of things you would have to do.
Yes, we had chores. We had livestock to take care of, cows to milk, hogs to feed. There was always something to do. And this continued on until I left home. I mean, there's always chores to do around the farm. And when things have to be done 7 days a week, it's it keeps you close by.
Mm-hmm. Did that leave much time in the evenings or the weekends for leisure, perhaps reading or whatever?
Well, we never worked on Sunday. Unless it was an absolute emergency, and in Oklahoma, normally people didn't work too much after noon on Saturday. After we came to California, I think we worked more on weekends than we did in Oklahoma. We were having to start over. But there was leisure time. Of course, we had to make our own things to play with, you know. But it wasn't all that bad either. We had a stream nearby to swim in and fish in and horses to ride. Back to no money again. I mean, you made do with what you had. And I really didn't know any difference.
Mm-hmm. When you look back on it, did you feel like you had a very happy childhood in Oklahoma?
I did. I had a very happy childhood in Oklahoma. I think I had a pretty happy childhood as a whole, actually. I know we worked very hard. We started very young. But I don't feel that it ever did me any harm.
Then when the Depression came, things became very difficult for your family, and you said your father no longer owned land.
Well, he didn't, but he moved a few miles from where he was and leased, I think it was 320 acres.
Hmm. And at that time, did you realize that things were getting rough?
Well, I didn't. I was just small. You know, but by the time I was 8 years old, I was beginning to realize, because I heard them talk, you know, about it, and they couldn't get anything, couldn't hardly sell anything. You couldn't hardly sell what you raised, because nobody had money to buy it. I remember one time my dad took 8 hogs to market and brought them back home. The buyer that normally bought the hogs that were ready for market from him couldn't take them. And they had no place to put them. Well, those were butchered and distributed out around the area. In those days, hogs weighed more at market weight than they do now, too, because they wanted them larger and fatter. So what do you do with 2,400 pounds of pork? And yes, things were bad. They were very bad, but like I was saying, if you're growing up during that time, then you aren't affected. You don't have the worries that the adults do. Mm-hmm. But over the years, you pick up on all this and look back. And God forbid that we ever have another time like those. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it can happen or not. Sure, times can get hard, but there'll still be a difference.
You mentioned when the men were going to the polling place to vote, they were talking about Roosevelt. Did it seem to you, even at that young age, did it seem to you that they were very hopeful that Roosevelt could do something about it?
Yes, they were.
They placed their trust and their hope in him and supported him?
Yes, I'm sure they did, in at least in that neighborhood. Because they had been brought so low financially that there just wasn't much hope left for them that they could see how things could get better without some big steps being taken.
Did you ever hear anything more about Roosevelt? Say, overhear your parents talking or other neighbors talking?
Oh, yes. Yes. Very much. As a matter of fact, I didn't know what this country was going to do when President Roosevelt died. That is when I learned that everybody can be replaced. I'll never forget the day that I heard he was dead. Here we were still in a war. What are we going to do? So that is when I learned that we can all be replaced. As a matter of fact, we all will be replaced. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was still a young man. I didn't hadn't learned a lot of lessons that.
Did your parents continue to be supporters of Roosevelt? As time went on?
Yes, but they also thought that there were some of the things that he should have dropped that was continued.
You mentioned the programs he had where they killed cattle and hogs.
They killed off a portion of them to get the price up. Nowadays, they're doing similar things, taking certain things off the market, certain produce, or to keep the price up.
At that time, did that take place near where you live? Did you know that this was going on, or did you hear this word of mouth?
It took place all around. I didn't personally witness the shooting of any of the livestock.
But
I know that it did go on because it was happening to neighbors and around, yes.
How did people feel about it?
They didn't like it. They didn't like it. But if it's program, if they instigate it, it has to be, at least I guess they tried to carry it out evenly. I don't know.
What happened to the meat?
People used as much as they could possibly use.
I've heard some people say that the government would burn them so that nobody could
well,
have that meat. But that wasn't your experience.
They didn't get it all. They didn't get it all. A lot of those people turned their back on that. And there were people that were, there were a lot of people starving to death in the cities. They were walking the countrysides trying to find something to do to survive. Nothing of that magnitude could happen again without, I think, a revolution is what would take place this time.
Did you ever hear about another one of his programs where he would pay farmers to plow under their crops or just not even plant the crops?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I've heard of those. Mm-hmm. We've had that in recent times as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking back then, if you knew of any of your neighbors or people in the surrounding counties might have done that.
No, I didn't experience that in Oklahoma. They had started it, but I personally didn't.
No.
But when we came here, it took place here in California, too. They even paid you to let what they call cover crop get so high before you plow it under. A soil conservation program to build the soil. The farming practices back in those days was very poor. They weren't refurbishing the soil with nutrients the government started the program to build the soil up.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the farming practices? I've heard that at that time, most of the farmers in Oklahoma didn't practice crop rotation.
They didn't practice crop rotation. They didn't seem to realize that they were losing the topsoil by not terracing on slopes to keep it from washing away. Mm-hmm. I've seen great gulches, ravines washed down at the ends of fields that came to a, too much of a drop in elevation. And lots of topsoil washed away. In the western part of the country, that had happened, and they had farmed too many years in a row the same thing. And when the drought did come, the wind blew the topsoil away because the wheat doesn't grow. Dirt just gets powdery and then the wind blows it away because you have a lot of wind in that country. Mm-hmm. just because you have drought years doesn't mean that you can't have a downpour of rain occasionally. And in that latitude, you have a lot of violent weather. Your southern, northern climates, you might say, clash at certain times of year there. And you can have a downpour of 4 or 5 inches of rain in 2 or 3 hours, still be a drought year.
But you feel that because of their farming methods, when the winds came, they did lose a lot of the topsoil then?
Oh, definitely. They should never have grown cotton in Oklahoma in the first place. They raised cotton. Cotton's very hard on soil. And it'd take pretty good land to start out with, and they'd start raising cotton just year after year.
Do you remember very much about the drought and the dust storms?
Yes, I can remember, not the dust storms. In eastern Oklahoma, we didn't get the dust so much.
You didn't see very much dust,
though. No. But the drought, I do. Because I remember when it was small, we hauled water for quite some time. The creek dried up. And we hauled water from a reservoir. It was a small man-made reservoir that still had water. I can remember one year particularly that we did that. But I also remember other people maybe wasn't as fortunate to be as near as good a stream as we were that did it long before we did. Mm-hmm. And of course that country's like anywhere else. Some wells are good, some are not so good. Some will go dry and others will still be good. And it was very common for people to be hauling water to water livestock. I know the last year that we left there, we had an extremely poor crop. Extremely poor. It's hardly worth harvesting. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that the drought had more to do with why you left Oklahoma than the Depression did?
Well, it had some to do with it, but my stepmother's health was failing. And that was the primary reason for us to leave at the time we did. Now, whether we would have left anyway, I'm not sure. I was always glad that we did leave.
Mm-hmm. What was wrong with your stepmother?
I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure, but the doctor did advise my father that it would be best if he thought if she was taken west to a different climate, to this particular climate out here. When she was a young woman, she lived in California for a little while. And her first husband died during World War I.
So there was no question when you decided to leave that you would come to California. You didn't consider going to some other state?
No, we didn't consider because two of my older brothers had already been out here. And they thought it was a good place to come to.
Mm-hmm. Had they written you letters about it?
Oh, they had written and they'd also been home. And one brother was in Long Beach in 1933 during the earthquake there. And he was almost killed in the earthquake. And my father came out to see him while he was still in the hospital. But why we came to the San Joaquin Valley was because it was farming country and my dad was a farmer at heart. And we only knew one family in the whole San Joaquin Valley. And we wasn't sure where they were. We didn't come to the valley because of them, but we later looked them up. But he just had it in his mind about 200 miles north of Los Angeles. And that's where we came.
Mm-hmm. Had you heard very much about California before you came out?
Oh, yes, a lot. A lot.
Did you have an idea in your mind what it would be like?
Well, I think we fantasized a lot. I thought there was an orange tree on every corner. And, but we found it easier to make a living here when we immediately came out than it was back there. I think it was because of the drought years there, though, mainly. For us particularly. If it wouldn't have been for drought years, I think our crops would have been better, but they paid a little bit more for working here.
Mm-hmm. But you're not at all certain then that had your stepmother's health been good that you would have come here?
No, I'm not sure.
You might
I'm not
have
sure.
stayed in Oklahoma then. Things might help. To that point, the breaking point as far as finances.
The things were not to the breaking point for our family.
Mm-hmm.
But
had
for,
you seen many other families?
Yes.
At that point and had left?
Yes. And also saw some come to California and come back, go back to Oklahoma again, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then return to California later. Many of them did that. It's pretty hard to pull up your roots and plant them elsewhere. And it was very common out here, particularly for the first 10 or 15 years. Somebody would come out here, and all you could hear them talk about was how much better things were in Oklahoma. So they'd go back to Oklahoma. Sometimes they'd have to borrow money to get back to California. And this has happened over and over. And people helped each other out here even. Other people would come out here from Oklahoma and hard up and no place to go. They'd stay with them until they could get a job and find a house.
Mm-hmm.
Housing was kind of hard to find in California at the time. A lot of people lived in tents out here even.
Mm-hmm. You had heard a lot about California. You had brothers that were here. And did you have very high expectations? Did you expect it to be just the answer to all your problems? Or
I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah. I think my dad was more realistic than that. And he knew that people here were not on Easy Street. And that there's no such thing as a free lunch. He knew that we'd work for what we got.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. We worked very hard here. But it was easier to get work here. That was the primary difference. And it paid more per day than it did in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Considerably more.
I wanted to go back just a little bit. You had mentioned something about an auction just before you left
mm-hmm.
in 1934. Could you tell me more about that? That must have been when you were trying to sell all of the things that you just couldn't bring with you to
Dad bought a truck to bring what we could. Now, there were 15 people to ride out on this truck and bring in addition to what we could haul, which wasn't a lot. That wash pot sitting right there was one thing that came. Sewing machine, the kitchen table, the legs were taken off and it was nailed across the bed, across the top of it like that. Things packed underneath it, bedding. I think my stepmother made up 2 5-gallon cans of cookies. Those were hanging on the back of the truck. And this picture that I get of that thing was as near the description of Steinbach's Grapes of Wrath as anything ever was.
The old oaky jalopy.
I would give, it wasn't a jalopy, it was a good truck.
It was a good truck?
That was a good truck. It was only a 5-year-old truck.
Oh.
And it had new rubber on it. Now you'd have to be a rich oaky to have new tires on a good truck when you came west, I suppose. But how much cash my dad had, I don't know. We didn't ask questions about finances. Ever. And but I could take a good roundhouse guess, and I doubt if he had $800 total after he sold it, because nobody had any money to pay anything for anything.
Mm-hmm.
We camped at the side of the road all except one night. The first night out, we stopped at an older brother that lived in Shawnee, Oklahoma. We got a motel, and there's too many to stay at his house. And one other night en route, we got a motel. But we were en route for 11 days. We didn't make too good a time because we had some engine troubles with the truck. And this delayed us quite a bit.
How long did that delay?
Well, we were delayed 2 days in Adrian, Texas. And then we broke an axle in New Mexico. That was another day's delay. And we didn't try to make too many miles. The roads were not too good then. They were not like they are now. Most of it was two-lane. And some of it was kind of rough. And this was a loaded truck. And we just camped outside the road. This was very common practice in those days.
Uh-huh.
You just pitched camp and you cooked and ate.
A fire and cooked beside
yes.
the road, too?
Oh, yes. And we came to Tulare, and we camped for a while and picked cotton.
On your way out, did you see very many other trucks that were loaded down with mattresses and things like that? That
not great.
Looking back on it now, might have been from Oklahoma.
Yes, very possibly, but not in great numbers. Maybe it's just at that particular time we didn't. But there were people on their way out, definitely going to California.
And there were other people who would camp out beside the road.
Yes, but we never camped with anybody, though.
Mm-hmm.
We always camped by ourselves.
Mm-hmm. How about when you got to the border? Now, you came the southern route through Arizona. Do you remember anything?
Yes, definitely. We spent one night there. There was another delay. We raised cotton also in Oklahoma, some cotton. And we had with us some cotton sacks that had been used. And due to the agriculture inspection, they were deathly afraid of the boll weevil in California, which they very well should have been. And we either had to, they would either destroy those sacks there or we had to boil them in water before they would permit us to bring them across. Well, they were pretty hard to come by. They were 9 foot, 10 foot, or 12 foot heavy duct sacks. And we were going to need them. So we just pulled out. It was a lot of open space out there and got their permission. And we camped that night, took that very pot right there, filled it full of water and kept it boiling and boiled those sacks. And they saw that we did. And I'll always give them credit for doing it.
Mm-hmm. And then they allowed you to come into the state.
And they allowed us to bring those sacks in with us. There was no problem getting into the state. There's nobody can stop you, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were they very polite? Were they nice?
They were very nice to us at the border. Very nice to us. We didn't have anybody really, mainly I think where we ran into our problems with children in school, of course. Children can be cruel, as you know, you've been a school teacher.
Yeah.
They can be very cruel.
But up to that point, at the border, you had no problems?
No, we had no problems.
When you came across into California, you would have crossed the desert and then come over the mountains. What was your first impression of California then?
My first impression of it was great, actually. The view, well, maybe it was the newness of it. I don't know. But to me at that age, I was used to really being outdoors because we'd hunted a lot at night in Oklahoma during the Depression. We sold the furs of the animals we caught or trapped. And it was just one a big adventure for me.
Mm-hmm. The whole sleeping out and the campfire bit probably didn't seem like
that was a ball.
You probably thought that was fun.
That was no hardship to me. Mm-hmm. If I'd have been older, it might have been a hardship. But as a 10-year-old boy, it was certainly no hardship. And I was a big, strong boy.
So you were very excited when you came here in California?
Oh, we were very excited. It was a big adventure for us as children.
And when you first came to California, you came up into the valley, and you said you settled first in Tulare?
We didn't settle in Tulare. We stopped there. We knew it was temporary because we took a drive off 99 Highway and found a nice-looking field of cotton and pulled in and asked if they needed help picking, and they did. So we stayed about 3 weeks and picked cotton.
Mm-hmm. Where did you stay for housing? Did you camp out then?
We camped out and was getting into September, and it wasn't too long till school started. My dad wanted to get on and tried to find a place to settle into so kids could start the school. And when we left Tulare, we came to Fresno. We pulled into Fresno on South Broadway and stopped and had some things to buy at a store. Found a market on South Broadway. And we left the city and went north on 99. It was getting late in the day, and we camped out on the west side of the highway. And my dad thought we'd come far enough north, so the next morning we loaded up. I remember my brother that was driving said, how far up 99 do you want me to go? And he said, well, just... I'll tell you when to turn off. And he had something in mind. Nobody knew what. He said, I'll tell you when to turn off. He got to Bullard Avenue, and there was a sign that said Clovis, 6 miles. And he said, turn here. And he started east on Bullard Avenue and came into the city of Clovis, which was a very small town at the time, 1,500 people. The day before, my cap had blown off my head, and I didn't miss it for a minute. I thought it landed in the back of the truck, but it hit the highway, and it was lost, and I didn't realize it until later. My father thought everybody should have a covering on their head, so he stopped at a store to buy me a cap. And while he was in the store, he asked the man, he said that he and two of his sons was looking for a job, possibly on a dairy. Did he know anybody around that had a dairy that was looking for help? And he told him yes. Charlie Arbuckle, 2 miles north of Clovis, needed 2 milk cans, or 3. They did a lot of milking by hand in those days, particularly grade B dairies. So we drove out to his ranch and sat there all day waiting for him to return from Fresno. And before nightfall, we were moving into a house that he had for his hired hand. It was only a 3-room house.
But it was a house.
But it was a house. And there's where we set up housekeeping. And I think school had started by then, and we started to school. We had to walk about 3 miles to school.
Uh-huh. From the time that you came to California until you moved into that house there, about how much time had elapsed?
Oh, probably a total of not more than a month. Uh-huh. The job paid $40 a month. And there were cows standing at the milk stanchion at the time, about 35 of them at a time, normally. And they had to milk them by hand, which meant that, they got up about 4 o'clock in the morning and started, and they finished up 7 o'clock or so in the morning. And then during the day, if he needed somebody in the field, he paid them by the hour. But the milking job paid $40 a month in that house. And the rest of us worked at whatever we could get around the area for other farmers. Subsisting then meant, with that many in the family, you had to can a lot of stuff. And of course, fruit and stuff was readily available in those days. I can recall back when going out to somebody's tomato patch, and you could pick all the tomatoes you wanted to for 10 cents a lug and pick your own tomatoes, which meant you got good tomatoes. Fruit, a lot of it was just given away. In those days, they wasn't getting a very good price out of things here either. We picked grapes in the Clovis area for as low as a cent and a half per tray. We picked up dried figs off the ground, and lots of times it was grassy underneath them. They hadn't been cared for very well, because the farmers couldn't afford to keep those farms up like they could if prices were good. We picked up dried figs for as little as 5 cents a 40-pound field box. And I don't think you could probably pick up more than 8 to 10 boxes of them a day under those conditions. Some of them worked for as little as 20 cents an hour. The following year, when the cotton was planted out here, we chopped cotton, which consisted of thinning it and removing any grass or weeds in the row, for $1 per acre. And like I said before, prices were better here than they were in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And these houses were uninsulated, but wood cook stove, a wood heater. And
how long did you live in this house that was at the dairy?
We lived in it a year, approximately.
Could you describe the house to me?
It was just a bungalow-type house, 3 rooms in a row. One door opened right from one to the other. There's no hallway. If you took an elongated building and partitioned it off, uh-huh, 3 spaces, that was it.
Did it have an indoor toilet, or was
that? No, it was an outdoor toilet. That one didn't even have a sink inside. It was a faucet outside for water. Of course, we had no washing machine. When you washed, you took this 20-gallon wash pot and you put it up on brick, those 3 little legs there, and you set it up on the brick and you built a fire under it. And you had a wash tub and a sturdy bench to set the tubs on, 2 tubs. And you scrubbed the clothes in one and rinsed in the other. And my folks always insisted on you being clean. And the house had wooden floors. You also scrubbed those down with homemade lye soap periodically. Mm-hmm. And wash day was quite a deal. It was a big thing. And it took most of a day. And, of course, nobody had too many clothes, but if you only had 2 pair, they got washed often. And you never went to school dirty.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many of you were living in this house? There were your parents, and how many?
Well, let's see. At that particular time, I'll have to think back and count them, but I can. Would you like the names?
Well, that's okay.
Let's see. Jack, Loretta, Michelle, John, Eddie, Basil, Ted, Arvin. Right at that present time, there was 8 kids.
Okay, so there are 10 of you.
Instead of 10, well, 2 of the others had gone elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So there were 10 people.
10 people at that time living in that 3-room house.
This must have been difficult for your stepmother to go from living in a much larger home.
Well, if it was, she didn't complain about it. She didn't complain.
Mm-hmm.
She did what she had to do. She was very cheerful about it.
Did she try to make it homey and try to fix it up right away with what she had? Or?
With as much as she had, she would put up curtains, but she was never one for interior decorating.
Mm-hmm.
Very plain. She really had no knowledge of anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Now you probably didn't have any furniture.
We brought, like I said, the large dining table that was nailed across the top of the bed of the truck, and we had 6 cane bottom chairs that we brought. And we made benches for the long table on either side of it. And used those until I left home. There was benches on the side of that long dining table.
Did your mother also work in the fields?
She did some. She did particularly in 1935 because my dad got sick. And he was bedfast for about 6 months. So she took 4 of us. By that time, 2 more of my brothers left home. And she took the 4 that was available in the summertime, and we'd go out and work. The following year, when my dad got sick, we leased a 40-acre place.
Mm-hmm. You moved from the dairy
We moved from the dairy farm
to a 40-acre place.
To a 40-acre place, and we farmed it and then worked other farms around.
Mm-hmm. Were you better off financially then?
Not really. There wasn't much change there. There really wasn't a big change until the following year. Well, there was a change, all right, but as far as being financially better off, I don't know. But the following year, we leased 160 acres in Madera County on 41 Highway. You passed it on the way up. It's all full of houses now. And it was 100 acres of orchard and vineyard and 60 acres of open land. But we still did it the hard way right at first because we didn't have the money to buy a tractor, and we farmed it with horses and mules. And we also managed to farm that and still do some work for the neighbors. It was never any end of the work. A lot of hard work.
Mm-hmm. But at that point, even though you were farming like 4 times as much, perhaps not that much, but you were farming more than you had with 40 acres, you still didn't have any more cash?
Well, not right at first, see, because you have an investment regardless of what you go into. If you increase the size of the operation, you have more investment. So it's like many farmers still operate today. They borrow money to make a crop with. My dad, having a good credit reputation, was able to borrow money as well as anybody. And being a very conservative man, he never borrowed a dollar extra you made do until you could get your crops in. But things were still very hard in 1936, and that's the year that we leased 160 acres. You cannot borrow money on orchard and vineyard in those days, and I don't think it's any different now before May 1st because of the frost danger. And because they have had severe frost in late April in the valley. And you borrow money on the crop, so the bank isn't going to finance the crop until they're reasonably sure that it's not going to get wiped out. Even then, you sold raisins and dried figs for $40 a ton. It takes 3.5 pounds of fresh fruit to make a pound of dried fruit, approximately, if it's of good quality. And you didn't get that unless it met a certain standard. And it was still difficult. There was many things you didn't have that you needed to farm with. Finally, it was pretty hard to do it, but he had bought an old tractor and the thing blew up, and he bought another old one. After the third old tractor and it going haywire, he went way out on a limb and he borrowed money to buy a new rubber-tired John Deere tractor. That was the point right there where things got easier. Because you can do a lot more work sitting on a tractor easier than you can following a team of horses or mules. And I don't think we worked just as hard, but we got more done. And that brought more money in. Mm-hmm. Because we worked that tractor out for the neighbors also. Give you an idea how, if you want to compare it to today's prices, we disc 40 acres of land for a neighbor for $1 an acre. Our tractor, our disc, and our fuel. Fuel was 6 cents a gallon. So now, I don't know how much it would cost you per acre to get that same 40 acres disc, but I know what you would pay for that same tractor and disc now, if you were to hire it here, would be approximately $35 an hour. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure your profit would be more today, but we baled hay for another neighbor a couple of those years that we were on that ranch.
How long were you on that ranch altogether?
Well, my dad was on it 7 years, but I left to go into service in 1942.
And so you were there from about 1936?
To 1942 when I was there.
Where did you live, and did you have a home built, or was there already a home there?
There was already a home on it.
To live in?
It
How
was
much
a,
was the home?
It was a three-bedroom. And it was a good average ranch house. Today it wouldn't be considered a good house, but it was all right in those times.
How would you compare it to the home you lived in Oklahoma?
The two houses that I remember in Oklahoma were better houses than it was. Particularly the first one. It was a lot bigger home. But size would be the only difference, mm-hmm. really. Construction about the same. I mean, the climate isn't as severe here as it is there. You could be more comfortable in something like that in California than you would Oklahoma. You don't get as much cold wind here. But I'm sure there were hardships. I wouldn't want to go through it now. It would really be a lot harder on me now than it was then.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds as if that after you were on the ranch from about 1937 on, when you had the tractor, that things did get...
They got better for us. They got better for us. For one thing, we had plenty of work. And I know my half-brother and half-sister that was younger. My half-sister was 5 years younger than me, and my half-brother 7 years younger. Didn't have to work nearly as much as the rest of us did. And I was glad for them.
Did you know very many other kids your age, perhaps kids you had met at school, who were in the same situation that you were in, that whose families were renting farms of that size and farming?
Yes, yes, I knew under.
That was fairly common in that area?
Yes, it was. You came here during the Depression years. If you had any knowledge of farming, you could rent or lease land. It didn't take a lot of money to get started, particularly if there was enough in the family to do most of the work. And that was our situation. I mean, we could rent a fairly good-sized farm and do all the work except maybe right in the peak of the harvest, you had to have help to pick 40 acres of grapes because they have to be gotten off in a certain length of time so you can make raisins and get them in before the rain start.
And some of the people I've talked to that came from Oklahoma were not in as good a financial situation that your family was in. They had absolutely nothing when they got here and found it impossible to rent or lease a farm. And so they would, migrant workers who would, you know, travel from crop to crop.
That's true. That's true. They did. And a lot of them was in that rut for a long time. Yes, I knew people like that. I knew people that borrowed money to get to California. They ended up with absolutely nothing. And I know one family that started to California, and they heard that there was some work in southern Texas in the Rio Grande Valley. Well, they had enough money to get there, but not to California, so they went there. That area is somewhat like the San Joaquin Valley, only it's not as large. But they have some oranges and grapefruit. They got a job pulling the grass from around orange trees for a penny a tree. And they still couldn't make enough to get to California. And they borrowed money from my dad to get the rest of the way. And there were people that come here, they had no place to go, and they would stay with us that we knew. Some relatives, some friends. We always took them in.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you were aware then that you were much better off than most of the...
Well, yes, yes, I had to be, because else why you would be helping so many people. My dad was one of these people that anybody was welcome if they come along. If they were a stranger and it was time to eat, they came in and they ate. I saw that happen in Oklahoma, too. I saw it happen with a man and a woman that was carrying one babe in arms and leading one. It was very small. And she wasn't well, and it was a hot day. And my dad persuaded them to stay there for a couple of days until she got a little bit better able to travel. They were walking the country looking for something to do with no place to go. But things were different then. I mean, you trusted everybody until they proved otherwise. It isn't like now. You trust nobody until they prove themselves honest.
Mm-hmm.
seems to be the mood these days. Mm-hmm. I had trouble dealing with that for a long time. I still do, I think. I'm pretty easy to be taken the first time.
Do you think that other people were as kind as your family was to these migrants? Were there other families who also took them in? And
yes, there were others. I know relatives that did that all around. There probably was people that didn't. There were scoundrels from back there, too. And everybody has their different kinds of people, you know. You could rent a house. Like I say, I have to reflect back to really realize just how hard it was. But I can remember prices a lot. I can remember bread being 5 and 6 cents a loaf. I remember when it went to 7 and then to 8. And people were complaining. You could buy luncheon meats for 15, 16 cents a pound. If you didn't have enough money to go and rent a house when you could rent one of those old houses for $5 a month, then they had to be pretty hard up.
Mm-hmm. But many of them were.
Many of them were.
Hard up like that. Did you ever see any camps where they had, say, pitched tents or built small little shacks under bridges or?
I saw a number of them. I saw a number of them. I saw the biggest one I saw was at Tranquility in the west side of the San Joaquin Valley on the Russell Giffen Ranch. And there must have been at least 400 or 500 people in that tent city. And it was out in the gumbo type mud. It was in the wintertime. And they picked the cotton by hand before they used the cotton picking machines. It'd take them all winter long to get it picked. And those people would sit out there with nothing to do when it was raining and they couldn't pick cotton. And it was a really misery hole.
Mm-hmm. Did you see that from afar, or did you go up?
I went over there one winter. I went over there one winter to pick cotton during my Christmas vacation. And it started raining when we got over there. And as a matter of fact, we only worked about a half a day. And I stayed about a week in a tent. And I went with two of my brothers, and we gave it up and came home because it didn't look like it was going to be dry enough that we could work. And we went over to pick up some extra money.
Did you describe the kinds of conditions they were living under?
Well, if you can picture putting tents probably within 4 or 5 feet of each other, the tents in rows, with maybe 20-foot avenues between them. This area must have covered at least 5 acres. And they had outhouses built, and people got their water from an irrigation pump up at one corner of the area. And you cooked and ate with kerosene stoves. If you had any heat at all, it would have to be a small kerosene heater. A lot of them didn't even have that. And we didn't have a heater. We didn't have a heater in that tent.
In the ditch camp, were you aware of any problems with health or disease because of the poor sanitation and the conditions these people were living under?
I wasn't really aware of it. I know a lot of people, they were very unhappy with the situation there at the time, and while I was over there, because they weren't working. And they had to be desperately in need, they wouldn't have been there in the first place. Many of those people went on to steady jobs. This was a temporary thing for a lot of people. Some of them never seemed to be able to pull out of it, and they went from area to area. They'd go to Modesto and pick peaches when the peaches were in season, or they'd go when cotton picking started, they'd go to Bakersfield where they start first, and then they'd go north as it progressed. Many of them too, I think it became a way of life. They or maybe they lost their will to do any better, I don't know.
But do you think that many times they could have gotten themselves out of that situation?
Possibly if they'd have known how. Some of those people were uneducated too. And they didn't know how to get out of a situation like that. I think that was part of the problem.
You think they had probably lived, perhaps not like that, but still they hadn't lived very well in Oklahoma?
A lot of them didn't live very well in Oklahoma.
And tents in Oklahoma even then.
I think a lot of those people in that part of the country, the hunting and the fishing was pretty good. And I went back later into Oklahoma in 1940 and visited some of my uncles that were still there. And I had occasion to go down on the in the South Canadian River country at the time and observe some backwoods people that were still there. And that was a family with eight kids living in a one-room log cabin, dirt floor. They'd always lived that way. And what do you do when you take, say, some of those people and bring them to California? How do you bring them out of that sort of thing? Mm-hmm. You're not likely to that same generation. You may a generation or two later through educating them.
Do you remember seeing any government camps that they had built for the migrant workers?
I didn't see any. I didn't see the government. I didn't see the government build any in our area.
Some of them were built in, throughout the valley, but you didn't hear of.
Not in our area. And I wasn't aware that the government built any in the 30s. It might have been somewhere else, maybe around Bakersfield or Delano or someplace, but I don't remember any in Fresno. I remember in later years that there were some migrant camps built, but not during the 30s.
You mentioned that your father's health was bad for a time in 1935.
It was arthritis what let him down for a long time. But he got on his feet again and did a lot of years of hard work after that.
Was he under doctor's care?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But there isn't much that the doctor could do for him.
Mm-hmm. Was that a private doctor?
Yes.
Come to your home or
yeah.
Perhaps mm-hmm. go to his office?
Well, they made house calls in those days, too.
Mm-hmm.
He also
did your family
go in.
Was well off enough that they could afford to pay the doctor?
Managed it some way. Mm-hmm.
How about schools? We were talking about that for just a minute before, and you mentioned that you didn't really seem to have any problems about being from Oklahoma, except when it came time to going to school and some of the other children.
Oh, the other kids, you know.
Would
they'd tease you, and you'd have a fist fight or two now and then.
Uh-huh. So you did have a few fight.
Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, yeah. I've had more fights when we first came out here. About the time they say, okay, I'd put my fist in her mouth. But you learn, you get over that. And
what kinds of things do they say that would make you so angry?
Oh, just nothing. Just call you an okie. I didn't like the word. I never heard of it until I came to California.
And there was something about the way they said it that you thought was not a compliment.
Oh, yes, definitely. And they'd gang up on a kid if they had a chance, like any kids will do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I had quite a few fights the first 2 or 3 years. But that soon passed. In high school, didn't have any problem with it. Oh, there were still comments, you know, made, and there still is today. But I handled it in a different way. After a little while, you know, you'd joke back. And one favorite one was, I'd ask them if they knew why they didn't have any insane asylums in Oklahoma. No, why? Well, they sent all the crazy people to California to teach school. You know, so, you know, you learn to mm-hmm. cope with it.
Mm-hmm. Were there very many other children in your classes that were also what they would call Okies?
Not at first. There was one boy in that school at the time we started. And he welcomed us because he was really picked on. Mm-hmm. So, there was three of us boys at the time in our family. And not long afterward, another family in the area came, and there was another boy in that family. And he was the biggest one in school. And that helped.
Mm-hmm.
From then on, we did not really have as much problem.
Mm-hmm. Once you had a fight with them or
yeah,
stood up for yourselves, they seemed to back off.
If we stood up for ourselves, they'd back off, naturally.
Was there anything that sort of gave it away? For instance, did they teach you about your accent?
The accent would certainly give you away. Yeah. Oh, no question about it. We said y'all. Mm-hmm. Of course, we learned to drop that pretty quick. And I thought at the time that you guys, that was your favorite expression here, the kids then, you guys, and I'd never heard it used before. And they would tease us about saying y'all. I'd say, well, that's better name than everybody, Guy. I had a brother named Guy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Were there any other things that they seemed to pick on?
I don't know, but you know, looking back, I think a lot of that. Kids picked up on, they heard things at home.
Mm-hmm.
And there must have been some talk at home, or they wouldn't have disliked the fact that kids were from Oklahoma or anywhere else. You know, a lot of them didn't know where Oklahoma was. It was really foreign to them. It could have been an island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean for all they knew. And as a matter of fact, this is not a just a funny story, but this is a true fact. My dad had occasion to work with a Japanese man. They were helping a neighbor remove a vineyard, an old grape vineyard. In those days, they cut them off under the roots and then loaded them manually by hand on vineyard wagon and hauled them out of the field in piles and burned them, you know, to get rid of them, the stumps. Just walking along there, and the Japanese fellow, his English is pretty broken. And he says to my dad, he says, how long you've been out here from Oklahoma? And my dad said, about 6 weeks. Well, I don't understand. He says, I've been out here nearly 40 years. And I don't speak it as good English as you do. Yes, this happened. My dad told that the rest of his life and laughed about it. You only been here 6 weeks, and he says, you speak pretty good English.
Shows not all the ignorant people were from Oklahoma.
Well, I think if you would go back and ask people when the Korean War started, how many people knew precisely where Korea was? When the Vietnam War started, how many of us knew exactly where Vietnam was located? We might have known it was in Southeast Asia, maybe. But a lot of people wouldn't have known that. Mm-hmm. They'd never been made familiar with it. Question a lot of people today and ask them the specific location of certain states. And I think you'd find a lot of people would surprise you. They'd be hard put to tell you exactly where it is. Mm-hmm.
So after you got used to the teasing of the kids, in retrospect, you might chalk it up to ignorance and say, well, you have to consider the source. But at the time, did you think that way? Did you think, well, they just don't know? And
well, at the time, I don't know. Being a boy that age,
you took it pretty seriously then?
We took it pretty seriously. Of course, being a large bunch of boys at home, you're always fighting is nothing new to you. You grow up doing it, you know. And I think we had one teacher that was actually prejudiced. I'm sure she was. And it made it kind of hard.
Did she say things?
Well, I think we got the blame in some cases when we didn't have it coming. Mm-hmm. I know we did. And because of that, this stepbrother of mine and I got pretty ornery sometimes. We were pretty hard scrappers anyway. After we moved from there, though, really never had any more problems in school.
That was when you were at the dairy farm?
Yeah, at the Garfield School. That and also the first place we leased, we went to the same school, the same neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But after we came over to Madera County, it was a very small grammar school. And because Eastern Madera County wasn't too thickly settled at the time. And there was only when I started the school, there was only eight kids in the whole school. Mm-hmm. And but that time I was in the eighth grade. Mm-hmm. But I was still only 13 years old.
And you were helping your father at that time on the farm, and then you said you would go out and look for jobs here and there on other farms,
mm-hmm,
to pick fruit, mm-hmm, or whatever they might be. Did you work very much? Was this after school or on weekends or vacations or whenever you could?
When we got home from school, we had chores to do. We also had chores to do before we went to school. We worked on weekend. We worked during vacations. We worked all summer long, and we even occasionally stayed out of school for a few days at a time. Mm-hmm. When it was really critical, there were certain things to be done that he had to have help with. And we'd take turns doing this.
Mm-hmm. Did you consider that unreasonable, or did you just say, well, this has to be done?
I didn't consider it unreasonable. Just did what we had to do.
Did you think of it as a harder life than what you had had in Oklahoma? Or?
No, not really. Not really. The day started at 4 o'clock in the morning. And it stopped when it got dark, so there was no difference there. Mm-hmm. 4 o'clock was getting up time.
Mm-hmm. Because you were doing basically the same thing, your father had a farm in Oklahoma, a farm in California.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that your life was very much as it had been in Oklahoma?
It was, other than it was different at school here a little bit, I think. But even then, I would never have gone back to it by choice. A lot of people here thought they wanted to go back, and they did, and a lot of them would come back again. Very few of them went back and stayed. I never had any desire to want to go back again and live there. For one thing, I like the climate here so much better. And I think particularly for people that are poor people, for a farmer, for that matter, I think it's easier on him if he's in a milder climate, because your weather can be very severe there, very changeable. If you have to go out and do something out on the farm and there's a 40-mile-an-hour cold wind blowing, that's considerably different than doing it in the weather that we have here in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. Even though the valley can be miserable in the fog, but not quite that bad. You know, you get used to a lot of things. You don't even know you're... Maybe you don't know you're poor until after you grow up and look back on it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I was raised on soul food until I was 45 years old.
Mm-hmm. So you and the rest of the members of your family were glad that you came here?
I think so, yes, generally, because none of them ever went back and made it permanent. And I think that speaks for itself there. If they would have thought it was better there, I'm sure they'd have went back and stayed. But I had one brother that went back and stayed for a while. And he had a good job there, but he came back again.
I wanted to ask you, although you were not one of the migrant workers that would have gone from place to place and had a relationship with growers who would employ you, you did go here and there and pick food or cotton or whatever. Did you find that you got along well and were treated well by the people you worked for in these small jobs?
We got along very well because my dad was a person that would see that things got done the way they should be done. And this is what I think got us by. And we'd go back and work for the same people if they had anything to do. Like I told you once before, I think he was as honest as anybody could be. He worked at it. And I think it came through when he talked to somebody. I think people pick up on this in a hurry.
Uh-huh. So you never had any problems with the people who employed you?
We had no problems with the people who employed us.
Did you ever hear about migrants who did have problems, who were possibly taken advantage of by their employers?
Yes, I've heard of it, and in later years I saw it firsthand with Mexican people in Mexican labor camps, and I heard a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing went on with the people from eastern states when they came here. They were taken advantage of by a lot of ranchers. Heard a lot about it.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear anything about attempts to form unions to prevent things like this?
The first thing I heard about a union attempt was in about 1935 or 1936. But that never really got off the ground in the Clovis and Fresno area too well. There was a lot of talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any specifics, any names or anything, or was this very general?
I don't remember names in that particular instance, sir. It was pretty general. There was some talk that the cotton picking machine was being developed at the time. But up to that point, it had never been successful. And I remember some talk about the farmers were using that as a threat, that if they unionized, that farmers would go to machines quicker and put a lot of people out of work. I remember them using that ploy. And I'm surprised that it took so many years for the farm workers to organize. Really, it took a lot of years. And that was due a lot, I think, to the Mexican people coming in, so-called wetbacks. And then they had the programs, the braceros came, the green card carriers.
But do you think that the Okies were probably discriminated against much in the same way that you yourself saw Mexicans being discriminated against?
Well, in some ways, yes. But the people from Oklahoma, really up until about World War II, when World War II started, things started getting better. I never did think that we came out of the Depression through any of the programs that they had particularly. I think the war is what brought us out of the Depression. It also increased the debt an awful lot, but a lot of people had been out here from Oklahoma and was getting started enough that, particularly the ones that didn't go into service, a lot of them made a lot of money during World War II. They were getting set up and farming. And
so they were able to pull themselves out of it.
They were able to pull themselves out of it. A lot of your wealthy ranchers later actually took advantage of some of the Mexican labor, or Okies. There's no use in going in. Yeah, there's no use in going into names, but I can name a few of them. But I won't. They know who they are.
Do you remember any strikes during the late 30s?
We didn't have any in our area, but I heard of strikes.
Mm-hmm.
I heard of the ones down around the Pig Ranch, Tulare area.
I know your family was well off as compared to the others, so you never would have taken any government aid. But other families that you knew, especially the migrants, probably were in very, a bad situation where they probably had no choice but to take some help until they could get on their feet. Did you know very many of these people that did?
I didn't know too many of them personally. And people didn't talk as much about that then either. They seemed to be more reluctant to go for something like that. But I did know some. I really don't believe that I ever knew anybody that got it that didn't really need it. And possibly there's some people that should have gotten some and didn't, for the sake of their children, maybe. Or
perhaps they were too proud to take it.
Too proud to take it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It wasn't as easy to get as it is now, or at least was for a while. Maybe it's getting harder now, I don't know. But
talked about the hostility that some of the kids had in school. Did you find any problems, or did you hear about other people having problems when they went to church, or perhaps when they went into stores or other public places in town?
No, not really. When they went into town, they I don't know, wherever we went, they seemed to be glad you were there if you had money to spend. Really. I don't know. We came here and we worked and we everybody had the opportunity except one brother, the oldest one that was still at home when we left. When he came here, he was a junior in high school, and he couldn't go back to school that year because my dad needed him. And he's the only one out of the family that at least couldn't have finished high school. Now, he couldn't help him beyond high school, but if they dropped out of school before they graduated from high school, it was their own fault. Except with the exception of him, and he never did go back and finish. My dad was always sorry he had to do that. But that year he needed him so bad that... Mm-hmm. And...
Have you read the book, The Grapes of Wrath?
Yes, I read it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about that? Most people that I've talked to seem to think that it was a very large exaggeration of the way...
I think it was an exaggeration. As much so as your Indian and white man movies, the Indian always loses. And with the exception of Custer, I guess they let him win there. But I think the only reason that they let the Indians win then, there wasn't anybody else left to tell about it. No, I don't think it was a good book at all. I think it was degrading to the people. I think it was written to sell.
Do you remember when it came out and the furor there was over it, how it was taken off library shelves? And
yes.
Uh-huh. Quite a bit to do on that.
Yeah, I remember a lot of the people from Oklahoma were upset over it. But same ones, a lot of us paid money to go see the movie. And that's why it was done that way in the first place.
Do you think that it's possible that a lot of people who are not from Oklahoma or aren't aware of the migration to California might form their entire opinion of what Okies are from that book? They might just think
very possibly. Very possible.
The way all of them are.
It's very possible.
And then in that sense, that Steinbeck really...
Well, people are too... they're too quick to categorize anyway. It's kind of like, they say. Well, who is they? You hear this all the time. Sure, they say, well, gee, the Chinese, they do this, they do that. Well, they're so, so many different people that you just can't do this. You can't stereotype people. I find one thing interesting in California that we didn't have in Oklahoma. It sort of fascinated me from the very beginning was the different races of people. Most of them back there, they're either Indians or they're were white people or a mixture. You didn't have too many in our part of the country. So I wasn't used to Orientals at all. I'd never seen very many Italian people, just, you know, so I think that was one of the most difficult things for me to get used to was these different peoples having maybe some different customs. I'd never been around a lot of Mexican people, and it fascinated me, and yet it was kind of hard to maybe not to put them in categories too.
Mm-hmm. And most people have put the okay, definitely.
Yes, they did. And looking back on it, I don't approve it, but at least I understand it. Mm-hmm. And I can see what those kids were thinking and why they would resent anybody. Mm-hmm. And I think they picked it all up at home. I really believe that everything, just about everything, well, it has to start at home, family, and how they're brought up, their environment, the attitudes at home, the support that they have at home on getting an education. If they're from an uneducated mother and father, they don't know if their child is doing well in school or not. How can they possibly know? They don't, maybe don't know how to give them the support they need. A lot of them, you've probably seen it, never come in even for an appointment for a conference. They wouldn't keep it if they made one. They don't have the time to, or won't take the time that it takes to devote to a child to help them get an education. If they aren't educated, how can they pick up their homework and see if the child has even done the homework? They don't know if it's done or not. If he says it's done, it's done. They have a feeling as long as he's going to school, it's all taken care of. They'll go out and they'll work their fingers to the bone, they'll educate the child. He may be going to school, but he may not be getting much of an education. I determined that I would know what my children were doing in school, that I would keep up with it, and I did, and support them in it. And
could you tell me what your children are doing now, I guess?
Well, my son's an engineer, a hydroelectric. He spent 11 years with Edison, Southern California Edison in the hydro division, and then just last year went to work for the Corps Army Engineers. And my daughter is married to a hydro engineer, and he also went the route with Edison Power Company. And 2 years ago went to the Corps of Engineers, and now he's transferring to the Bureau of Reclamation in Colorado. This weekend they're moving.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how things changed for you and your family. You didn't go into the war until 1942, so there were a couple of years when the war had started. And I wondered how that had changed.
Well, it changed things at home quite a bit, because when my brother was just older than me and my stepbrother went into the service first, and on the farm it was getting hard to get help because there were so many men in the service. The feeling during World War II was such that people, I think, were more patriotic than they are at the present time, particularly during Vietnam War, Korean War. We had been attacked, and everybody wanted in on the action.
So that left a lot of work for you to do at home then.
Yes, but I also went in. And so that left a bigger than ever shortage. But that time my half brother and half sister were big enough to do quite a bit. And they hired more help. Prices on things started rising and they could afford to hire help. But it was still hard for him to keep the 160 acres going. And that's why in 1943 he moved south of Fresno and bought 40 acres mm-hmm. and got by with him working at
the. Could you tell me what you did during the war?
Well, I was with military intelligence, communications, and I was chiefly intercepting the enemy's messages. And of course, it was coding. I was not in decoding, but just in the interception of the code. And that's mainly what I did.
Mm-hmm. And so you were here, what, on the California coast, and then part of the time?
I was on the California coast, and then in the South Pacific, Pacific Pier.
Mm-hmm. And you received a special accommodation for?
Well, I and my group that was with me all received one. And we didn't get that until just before we got out of the service.
Mm-hmm. When you came out of the service, then you moved back to the Valley?
When I came out of the service, I moved back to Fresno. And are you interested in what I did afterwards?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I had quite a few different kinds of jobs for a while. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. But I had a couple of office jobs. I had worked for the Southern Pacific Railroad twice. I job hopped for about 2 years. And then I settled down a little bit into dry cleaning and went into dry cleaning. And didn't stay in that too long. It didn't pay too good. And in 1948, this would be 3 years had gone by, I started doing route work for Nehigh Products Company, selling wholesale. And I liked that. I stayed in that for 13 years. I worked in Fresno for the Nehigh Products Company for 7 years, and they sent me to Merced as manager of that area, and I managed for them for 5 years, and then bought the company out and became a distributor in Merced, Merced and Mariposa County, and a portion of Madera County. And I got out of that in 1964. And I didn't want to go back to inside work of any kind, not even a dry cleaning plant. So due to the dry cleaning experience, I decided there was enough carpet in the homes that I could make it in carpet cleaning and furniture cleaning. And that's what I've been doing since 1964.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that you built a couple of homes.
Well, this was in spare time. I'd hire a carpenter and help.
Have things changed a great deal since the 30s? Do you feel like this is totally another world?
It's changed a great deal. Some things never change, but as far as I think it's been a tremendous improvement in a lot of ways. I think sometimes we get carried away with progress. I think we're too quick to call things progress. I think some things are not as progressive as we'd like to think they are. Just forever wanting something to be bigger and better and newer and I think we've gone a little overboard on it. I think we tend to maybe put too much stock in material possessions. A a lot of people don't seem to be able to satisfy their wants. They've met their needs long ago, but they never can satisfy their wants. They want too much.
So you think maybe there's something in between this and the poverty that most people lived in the 30s? There must be a happy medium somewhere.
Well, I'm not sitting here and saying that you need poverty. I think we've gotten ourselves into a kind of a predicament where it comes to the way we distribute our wealth. And I really don't know what the solutions are, and I don't think anybody else at the present time does. I think there's enough in this country for everybody, but therein lies the problem. How do you distribute it? You just can't take it from somebody and give it to somebody else and things come out even. But I think they should never lose sight of the fact that people do not have an incentive to do something. They aren't going to do a great lot. You take the incentive away, if you give it to somebody long enough, they have no incentive. And they become almost worthless to society. If you somehow can show a person that if they do so much, they will profit by it. But if they don't do it, they will not profit. Then they're more apt to do something. Mm-hmm. That's the very reason, I think, when you have a calamity that people band together. Mm-hmm. You take a disaster of any kind can happen. You take a great earthquake. People from all over go in to help them out because they're needed. People need to be needed. If you take somebody and put them on welfare and you keep them on welfare all their life and they raise a family on welfare, they turn around and do likewise. About the third or fourth generation, what are they looking forward to? Welfare.
We talked before you were very glad you came to California.
Yes, I am.
You've never had any desire to go back to Oklahoma?
Not to live.
Not at all? No. Do you still have ties there? Is there any family at all?
Very little. I have an aunt that's still living this back there.
But
and
you don't make
some
regular
cousins.
Visits back there?
No, I don't make regular visits anymore.
So California really does seem like home then?
Oh, definitely. Yes. I'll put it this way. California is, I'm a Californian by choice. And I certainly have no regrets at having been born in Oklahoma either. I've seen both ends of it. And I would say to anybody, if you have nothing, start out here, not back there.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find it easier.